Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, here with my co-hosts, Amelia Sorensen and Bob Anders. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Susan. Good morning, and hello, KHOI listeners. Some of you may recognize my voice from my regular radio show, which is aired on Thursday morning at 11, and that's Bob's 8-Track Garage Sale. And I'm happy to be joining you both. And Amelia, good to see you.
Thanks, Bob. I'm really glad to be back for a second week on Local Talk, especially since yesterday we had a chance to take a trip to South Story Bank and Tristan Huxley, where we could see the art that Liz Lidgett told us about last week.
Our first interview will be with Kevin Brooks, a president of South Story Bank and Trust. I was eager to team up with both of you for this road trip because you know something about banking. Bob's a retired Ames banker, and Amelia's father is a banker in Denmark. So you had some good questions to ask Kevin Brooks, South Story Bank president.
But our trips didn't end here. Susan took me with her to Boone County Historical Center to introduce me to the history of the area.
Now we visited two counties in central Iowa, so I thought we should round out our program by hearing about some of the geology and spectacular scenery of White Rock Conservancy in Carroll County. Ursula recorded an interview with the director, Conrad Kramer, a couple of years ago, and this seemed a good way to introduce Amelia to a trip she could continue later in the fall.
Well, we have a lot of ground to cover here this morning, so let's get started. We drove down to South Story Bank and Trust in Huxley, Iowa.
I'm very grateful you were there to do the interview. I learned a lot about banking.
And so did I. This bank was a lot different than the banks I've seen in Denmark. Let's listen in.
The state of Iowa is really unique. Second most banks, I believe, of any state in the union besides Texas.
And yet Iowa is losing population. So what are those banks doing? And I want to turn this over to Bob.
We'll transition to Bob. That'd be great.
Well, thank you. I'm Bob Anders, and you?
Kevin Brooks.
Kevin.
President and CEO of South Story Bank and Trust, Huxley and Slater, with a loan production office in Ames.
Well, Kevin, can you give us basically a review or a history of the South Story organization? That in alone.
Certainly, Bob. Thanks. The South Story Bank got started and chartered in 1954. And at that particular time, there were, I believe, 8 business people in this town of Slater who felt that it was important for that community to have its own bank. At that time, there happened to be a credit union that had served Slater that was moving out of town, going back to Ames. They were originally from Ames. And so this group of 8 business people came together, started the charter, and began South Story Bank in 1954. From that, one of the individuals that they hired and brought on at the beginning of this bank charter was a gentleman named Tom Dunlap. And Tom served as the finance and the banker for a number of years. And over the course of those years, Tom ended up acquiring ownership in the bank. And over time, the Dunlap family ended up owning all the bank. And during that phase, during the 1960s, early 60s, they chose, South Story Bank, chose to branch out and open up an office in Huxley. And so from the early 60s through our present time, South Story Bank has covered Southern Story County, was the bank of choice for Southern Story County, being Huxley and Slater, and this Ballard School District, which also includes Cambridge and Kelly. So it operated very similar to its original beginnings. It was just focused on the two communities for which it served. And they did a fine job of serving those who wanted to bank with them from Huxley and Slater. However, beyond that, they really didn't reach out and try to develop relationships to speak of. Then, in 2006, the Garce family, for which is one of the more predominant agricultural names in the state of Iowa, they had been in banking now for over 80 years, And they had banks in Audubon and Jefferson and Perrier Dell. And they wanted to redeploy some of their capital and expand their banking footprint. And they wanted to go where there was economic growth in the state of Iowa. In the state of Iowa, there's really two primary corridors that have that economic growth. And by far, the territory from Des Moines to Ames is the most vibrant of any portion of our state of Iowa. There is population growth. There's expansion of business and industry. And so there's a lot of good things that are materializing in this area. So they had observed other bankers who had moved into the more metro-type market of Ames, Des Moines, Ankeny. And during those 90s, early 2000s, a number of those banks, when we had an economic downturn, experienced some bad outcomes because how you manage and operate a bank in a metro area is different than that of a rural market. And some of those banks who did that expansion didn't realize the differential on how you have risk management. But the Garst family and leadership did. And as a result, they didn't want to actually move a bank into Ames, Des Moines, or Ankeny. They wanted to be in this geographic area and have some similarities to banks that they have owned and operated for years and years. And hence, they identified that between Ankeny and Ames, there was Huxley and Slater, as well as a couple other communities that had banks. Doug McDermott, who was my bank mentor, hired me in the Garst banks in 1983 in Jefferson, Iowa, still serves as an advisor for the Garst family and serves on our bank board of directors here at South Story Bank now. He had served on the Iowa Bankers Association board of directors in the 80s with Tom Dunlap. And he realized as they were doing the strategic plan of expanding their bank footprint, that Tom Dunlap has matured in age, family not as interested in banking as what maybe they once were, and so he reached out and asked the Dunlap family if they'd be interested in selling Huxley and Slater banks. And that's how it started. And so in February of 07, the Garst family took over ownership of South Story Bank.
So the change in ownership from the actual South Story founders and the evolution of those founders to the Garst family, what is the holding company that essentially owns this organization?
Yeah, it's a green investment company, is a holding company. And that green investment is the owner of Audubon State Bank, Home State Bank in Jefferson, and South Story Bank in Huxley and Slater. The Garst family also has majority interest in Perry Investment Company, which is another holding company that owns Raccoon Valley Bank with offices in Perrier Dell Dallas Center.
South Story, we're in a rural area here. We do have industry, no doubt about it. And you indicated, Kevin, that the corridor, the Des Moines Ames corridor, is one of the more vibrant. I assume the other is the Iowa City Cedar Rapids corridor. They're both anchored by these wonderful state universities. What percentage would you say of your business is ag lending, and how do you feel a community bank is more, how do you feel they're a better ag lender than maybe another bank?
South Story Bank, when I joined the organization in 09, we developed a strategic plan that we were going to be a corridor bank. And this was before the whole thing came out a few years ago, that this geographic footprint is now called the Cullivision Corridor. In 09, we started referencing our marketplace as the corridor. And so that marketplace is from Ames to Des Moines, Altoona to Waukee. And so as a result of that, we started out in 09 being a $50 million bank. Today we're a $160 million bank. Back in 09...
Excuse me, Kevin, just to clarify that for our listeners... That means
our total assets.
Assets.
So our total assets, we started at 50 million, and now we're 160. We are one of the fastest growing banks in the state of Iowa. We went from having a loan portfolio in the low 30 million in 09 to today, we originate, manage, and yes, I have to share that we use other community banks, including those that are Garst-related banks, to sell loan participations to, but we manage over $200 million worth of loans. So from 2009 to now, we've grown our loan relationships from $30 million to nearly $200 million. And again, it has been a great testimonial to those people in this Calivation Corridor, or what we call the Corridor, who have chosen to bank with bankers who can create financial solutions for businesses, and hence most of our highest concentration of loan relationships and deposit relationships are candidly with commercial businesses. About 50-some percent of our relationships are business. About 20% is agriculture. And so we're in the heart of the agriculture area. We believe that we need to focus on growing our ag portfolio, and our ag portfolio has grown. When I arrived in 2009, we had a very small ag portfolio. For whatever reason, prior ownership didn't have a lot of relationships with agriculture, and we've continued to expand that. And we believe even in these challenging economic agricultural times that there is opportunities, good banker and a good client, to figure out financial solutions and objectives for long-term outcomes.
Now, Kevin, my background is in retail banking, mm-hmm. and we talked about that. What retail banking is, as I understand, and you can certainly clarify this or for our listeners, retail banking is banking for the people who may work at one of these industries. They don't own a business. They don't own a farm. They may not even own a home. They may live in a family home, or they may have a rental. But they're a retail consumer of the bank. They have a checking account. They have a savings account. They need to buy a car. They need to have a credit card. I assume your bank also provides those services. And most community banks do. Am I correct?
You're correct. We actually put a lot of emphasis on retail, as you call it. And if I would try to define it, it's about providing personal financial services, be it consumer loans or installment loans, be it deposits, investment options, or home mortgages. I put the home mortgage business in that as well. And so we have approaching nearly 30% of our client relationships are of retail nature.
Now, there's another thing I want to talk about here, and that is this amazing art collection that is part of the Green Investment Company, or part of the South Story Collection. There are two things I want to talk about here. One is the bank-owned art. The other is your revolving community art exhibits. There is a Grant Wood piece here in the lobby, and that is extraordinary, Kevin. That is absolutely extraordinary. How did the bank-owned art collection start? Did it start when Story County moved into this larger group ownership? And just touch quickly on your revolving exhibits as well.
Well, the Garst family has a real appreciation for the arts. And so when we constructed our new facility and opened up in 2011 in Slater, we had some discussion about art pieces. And then when we opened this location in Huxley in 2014, 3 years later, it became a part of the budget items for which we established as a part of the construction project and establishing our administrative offices here in Huxley. And so right now, all the bank art is, there's 50-some pieces of art that's all original. All the art in the whole building, both floors, is all original art. None of it is prints. It's all original. And we put together an art committee that helped do that selection. And so it was a unique process that's been very much appreciated. We've had elementary school children and art teachers come through and do art tours. And we've had people from out of state come and look at our art collection. And so we're really fortunate. There are two pieces of art that we do not own that are on display at South Story Bank.
When you say we, who is we?
There are two pieces of art that the South Story Bank does not own that has on display in the Huxley office. Okay. those two pieces. One you've referenced is the Grant Wood, and one of our team members here at South Story Bank has a relative who ultimately received this piece of art through family. And it had been on display in the Figge Art Museum in Quad Cities up until the time. And he reached out to our bank and offered South Story Bank the opportunity to display this. He thought it'd be much more favorable to have it in central Iowa, for which is geographically where he grew up, versus in Quad Cities, for which he had no connection to. So that piece of art of Grant Wood is on display in our bank lobby. The other piece of art on our that's on display that's not owned is a sculpture piece that's located inside the front door that's made out of limestone. And actually, a local artist who lives just north here, Ron Dinsdale, is the artist for that and grants us that permission. And then one of the pieces that we have that was commissioned for this building is a piece of art that is on the exterior of the bank, which is a big blue stem grass that just looks magnificent in the evening as it is lit and sways in the wind. So it's a great piece. Now, relative to the community art wall, which was the other part of your question, it's located inside the lobby. And on a quarterly basis, we rotate that particular art. And that comes from artists who are located in the corridor. So we send out a letter offering people to put on display their artwork. And so we'll change it out quarterly. However, we maintain 2 months in the spring for which the Ballard High School and the North Polk High School have their art student work on display as they finish up that year, so we give that recognition.
We just heard from Kevin Brooks, president of the South Story Bank and Trust in Huxley, talking with Bob Anders, retired banker, co-host for this morning's program. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. In addition to Bob Anders, today's co-hosts are Amelia Sorensen and Susan Franzen. That's me, reporting on three counties in central Iowa. This is a whirlwind tour for our Danish visitor, Amelia, as she learns about life and nature in central Iowa. After leaving Huxley, we dropped Bob off and continued to Boone to see how the Historical Society had recovered from the collapse of a portion of its facade. If you look on the Boone County Historical Society website, you'll see what the collapse looked like and how the exterior has been renewed. Amelia accompanies me as we walk up the steps to the new exterior and meet the new executive director of the Historical Society, Mara McKay. She's expecting us.
They got all the damage repaired. You know, fortunately, nobody was hurt here. But I'm really curious to see what they've done with the inside. You know, they just had a dedication for Fairway Hall. Oh, here's the director, Mara McKay.
Pleasure to meet you. Glad to see you here.
This is the first time I've been here for quite a while, and you have quite a few upgrades since the last time I was here. This blue carpet and the
beautiful walls. We have all the ceilings repaired in the entryway, and the walls have been repaired, as well as our, as you mentioned, our fairway gallery, which is what we're looking at right now. You're standing on fully restored maple hardwoods. These floors were recently restored, and aren't they gorgeous?
They are gorgeous. And it's a big change from the dark, dark floors I saw when I was here before.
Absolutely. It's brightened the whole room, and we're happy about that. And we have a new sign and a new docent station. We also have the Fairway Gallery canvas with the Fairway store that was here in 1938. We have an original piece off to your right. That original piece was in the Masonic Temple tucked away, and we decided to pull it out. It seemed quite beautiful in this room. And you're also looking at our first rotating exhibit. That rotating exhibit is the 100th anniversary of our Boone Municipal Band. and it's called the Typical Midwest Band. It's just a wonderful collection of instruments, everything from saxophones to cornets to flutes and French horns, drums and musical pieces that have carried through the years. So we've put that on rotating exhibit for the next 3 months. And also you're seeing on the left side of this room the founders, or some of the founders of Boone, Mr. Aldrich and Mr. Erickson, off to your left, with all of the different accoutrements that we have, would be some of the players, the early American players from the era that this building was built, which was a 1907 Masonic temple, as the original building was used for. And then in 1990, the Boone County Historical Society purchased it from the Masons. And here we are so many years later working on some really extensive restorations.
Well, no wonder it looks so much better than when I was here before.
Well, thank you, Susan. I'm excited about it, and so is our membership. And our volunteers have been increasing as they see the new rooms and the galleries. And we can walk through if you would like.
Oh, of course. And I'm a little curious now. Is that Fairway photograph the first Fairway store?
It is the first Fairway store here in Boone. And we're very proud of that. And they earned this recognition when we were considering who to name this entryway gallery for. We decided that as one of the prominent
The various rooms she showed us were very impressive, but it was a little hard to follow how they fit together all.
I can understand what you mean. For me, it was just the opposite, though. I've done several programs relating to Boone County, so the pieces fit together for me. For example, the Carl Fritz Henning room was especially interesting because I know how he worked to make the people of Boone County realize what a treasure the ledges are. And he was helped in this with the help of Aldrich and Erickson. One was a legislator and the other was a newspaper man in Boone, and they had a campaign for years. Those men have marble busts in the Fairway Gallery. So when I saw those, I thought, oh, those are the people who made the ledges possible. And have you been to the ledges yet?
No, unfortunately not. But I'm sure I will.
Do you know about it?
Well, I've heard about it, but that's all.
Okay, well, maybe after you hear about the geology that's mentioned at White Rock, you'll have an even greater appreciation for it.
I'm sure I will.
The real treasure of the museum is the Kate Shelley room, and I think of the whole Historical Society. They have a station at the location where she once worked, a railroad station, and they have a lot of information down there about her famous deed. Children literally come from all over the world because they've read about Kate Shelley. I heard that she's in textbooks in China. Have you heard about her in Denmark?
No, not really in Denmark, but you told me a short story about.
Yes, but I found a lot of people who moved to Iowa haven't heard of her either. But it's a great story, and Amara Mackey told me about the plans they have to give the visitors a sense of Kate Shelley's adventure. They want to add special effects. Before I play her telling about those plans, I wanted to tell you the story with some special effects of my own. This story is in Kate Shelley's own words. She often traveled to give lectures about the dark and stormy night when she crawled across the Des Moines River Bridge to save the train. Here's her story. I went around the bluff in a semicircle behind and to the south of our house until I reached where the turn of road finds the cut in the spur of the bluffs, and then ran east along the track back to the broken bridge. As I came down the track, the lightning lit up the awful scene. Wood, the engineer, seeing me by the vivid lightning flashes or catching the gleam of the lantern in the thick darkness, called out to me. He was caught by a branch after being swept from the cab and was safe in a tree.
in the midst of the swelling flood. His brakeman, Agar, was fortunate also in catching to a tree or a willow, but the other two of his hapless companions were lost, and only one of them was found, O'Donohue, the section man. He called to me again and again, but neither one of us could understand what the other said, for the raging of the elements, and I turned toward Moingona, lying across and west of the great bridge. Hardly had I passed where now is the cottage of the old watchman when my feeble little lamp went out, and I was all alone. Only in the flashes of lightning could I now see the structure before me and the path I had to take to cross it. Those who cross a railroad bridge on a swiftly moving train can form no conception of the sensation of it that a traveler experiences who attempts to cross on foot a long and unprotected stretch of bridge timbers. 500 feet of bridging lay before me, and a misstep would send me down below the ties into the flood that was boiling below. The Des Moines River, into which the hundreds of streams in its watershed had been pouring all that evening and night, each one swollen like Honey Creek, was a furious flood that had pushed all bounds and covered all the lands about that were lower than the village, and was now straining hard at the bridge. The thunder and lightning were incessant. Fortunately for me, the downpour of rain had slackened somewhat, but the wind had come up and was blowing a gale, which made the passage still more perilous. I got down upon my hands and knees, carrying yet my useless lantern on my arm, and guiding myself by the stretch of rail, I began the weary passage of the bridge. I do not know how long I was in crossing, but it seemed an age. Halfway over, a piercing flash of lightning showed me the angry flood more clearly than ever, and swept along upon it a great tree. The earth still hanging to its roots was racing for the bridge, and it seemed for the very spot I stood upon. Fear brought me upright to my knees. I clasped my hands in terror and in prayer, I hope, lest the shock should carry out the bridge. But the monster darted under the bridge with a sweeping rush, and his branches scattered foam and water over me as he passed. Finding that I was yet unharmed, I resumed my painful and laborious mode of progression, and at length, I know not at what length, reached the solid ground, and then for a moment I stopped to breathe and straightened up for the run to the station, something more than an eighth of a mile distant. It was getting late, and how I told the tale, it would be hard to say, but I remember someone said, "The girl is crazy." I think it must have been the operator who said it. The girl must have lost her mind, as I told of the loss of number 11 and her unhappy crew. But Mr. McIntyre said, "My God, that's Kate Shelley." And they were soon able to realize the dreadful burden of my errand. The pusher that helped up the hill to Ogden was in the yard. Her screams soon brought the whole town around us. Everyone seemed to be up and about, and a body of men with ropes and material made ready to go over the bridge. They took me along with them to the scene of the disaster, and I led them around the face of the bluff as I had come, crossing the tracks above the house and coming down along the track on the eastern side of the washout, where alone help could be offered to the suffering survivors of the wreck.
So that is the story. And when you've heard the story, you can see a number of things in this room. The original lantern and the gold medal that the legislature gave her almost immediately after she recovered from 3 months. She was pretty sick after that adventure. But the big thing, and they'll tell about that, is they have a stretch of bridge that's a frame, and they now have, well, they did have a photograph of railroad ties going over water. But now let's hear what they have in store for the new Kate Shelley room.
So you're getting ready for the big change on the bridge,
yes,
right?
Yes, we're getting ready for it. You're exactly right. You've been here before. I love that. Yes, Susan, we're hoping to, with our CAT grant funding, to actually put real water and real tracks that would go across the bridge and then put motion-censored noise that we could include storm noises, train noises, so that our youth could walk through this train and our adults too, because we all love it to have an experience like that. So you'd actually be able to walk through this bridge and feel perhaps a little bit more of what Kate Shelley would have felt in this Kate Shelley gallery.
July 6th, 1881, a fierce storm was raging. The rain just wouldn't stop coming down. The river and creeks were flooding in the Des Moines River Valley near the railroad station by Mondona Town. Around 11 in the evening, a pusher train went out to search for men looking for washouts along the track. Past the Shelley family home, a mighty crash the Shelleys heard. The Honey Creek Bridge had just collapsed. 15-year-old Kate Shelley ran outside into the storm, saw two men trapped down in that river grave. She couldn't rescue them herself, but knew that midnight train would be sooner coming down the tracks this way. 100 years from now, folks will still speak her name. Kate Shelley will always be that girl who saved the train. Kate had to hurry to warn Mondona Station, and that old trestle bridge was the only way. Darkness and the storm, she crawled on her hands and knees across that tiny catwalk in the pouring rain. Halfway across the river, a tree crashed into the trestle. Kate was sure that shaky bridge would fall apart. Just at the last moment, that tree slipped through the pier's knees, the fear of death beating in her heart. Reached the other side, she ran to Mondona Station, warning them that the bridge had just washed out. The agent stopped the train just before it passed through, otherwise that train would have been hellbound. 100 years from now, folks will still speak her name. Kate Shelley will always be that girl who saved the train. Kate led a rescue train and saved the two men in the river, and Lord, only two men lost their lives. Many more would have died if not for this young girl's courage. What bravery Kate Shelley showed that night. What bravery Kate Shelley showed that night. 100 years from now, folks will still speak her name. Kate Shelley will always be that girl who saved the train. Kate Shelley will always be that girl who saved the train.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area, where we explore the people and stories and events in central Iowa. You just heard the Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Now, aren't you going to tell us about White Rock? What is so special about the geology there?
One of the special things about this part of Iowa is that the last glacier, called the Wisconsin Glacier, reached it. And as it melted, it created rivers and streams, dumped gravel and topsoil, and left a lot of the landmarks we take for granted. For instance, the gravel that was removed from what is now Ada Hayden Park, the lake there, was deposited by the glacier. And the director of the White Rock Conservancy explains the area in relation to the glacier. I found it interesting, and I hope you will too. We're going to hear from Conrad Kramer.
Well, White Rock is two things. White Rock is a place. So the White Rock Valley has been called by the local people for generations. It's a beautiful river valley that extends along the Middle Raccoon River. And White Rock Conservancy is a nonprofit land trust that was founded 10 years ago to accept an amazing 5,500-acre gift by the Garst family and to steward it as a landscape and to pursue our three-part mission out there on the landscape.
So to be clear, a land trust, in a sense, is a piece of private property that's been turned into property for the public to use and to visit?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of land trusts, but in our case, yes. We steward and manage this large property, and one of the important parts of our mission is to open it to the public, very much like a recreation area, like a state recreation area. And we also pursue other aspects of our mission. One is sustainable agriculture. We practice sustainable agriculture, and we work to demonstrate sustainable agriculture for Iowans and for people in the Midwest. And we also are working to restore our landscape into what it used to be pre-settlement times. And, in fact, we're the largest private restoration effort in the state. And, in fact, we're the third largest recreation area in the state. And here we are, just a nonprofit.
Why is the land geographically and geologically significant at White Rock?
Well, it is. It is very special. It's we're right on the boundary between two landforms in Iowa. We're right at the southern tip of the Des Moines Lobe, which is an area that was glaciated about 15,000 years ago. And that's what left all the wet prairie pothole area in Iowa that the pioneers found to be very fertile. And once they drained it, they could make good use of it. But right there is where the last glaciers were. And just below that, we're right on the boundary between the Des Moines Lobe and the drift and the southern Iowa drift plain, which has not been glaciated for 600,000 years. So we're right there where all the terminal moraines are and other
– where all the what are?
When the glaciers came down through Iowa, the last one, where they stopped – you know, plowing the landscape is right at White Rock. And so they left these hills, you know, which is basically where the glaciers plowed up a hill, you know, all along through White Rock. So we have these terminal moraine features. We have these rocky knobs that are basically crevasse dumps, you know, where the glaciers started to melt and these crevasses opened up and all the rubble fell down through and ended up giving us these little hills that are very special. Also, when the glacier sat there in 15,000 years and started to melt, it created this huge torrent of water along the Middle Raccoon River. And the Middle Raccoon River was very powerful at that point and dug down into the bedrock. And so at White Rock, you can see almost 200-foot bluffs. You're looking at 230 million years of erosion there. And you can see 230 million years of strata. And then just on the other side of White Rock, in the southern part, is the driftless area, the southern drift plain, where it hasn't been glaciated for a long time. And so you have, 600,000 years of erosion. And so we have a lot of terrain along the river, these river valleys and these valleys and ravines running up the creek. So we've got a lot of elevation change and a lot of interesting terrain, which you don't usually associate with Iowa.
Yeah, I think the word bucolic comes to mind. It takes on this very charming, beautiful, rolling hills and valleys.
It is beautiful. And another special thing about it is since the terrain was rough, some of those areas out at White Rock never felt the plow. And so we actually have some prairie remnants and some savanna remnants, some rare sand prairie remnants. So it's a special wild place.
And it's really not an exaggeration to say that it's stunning. One is immediately struck by the breathtaking quality of the landscape. And there's really an intense awareness of nature when you go there. It's hard to put it into words. It's a palpable sense of power and integrity of nature when its systems are protected and supported and are kind of coming into the foreground. And you get a glimpse of Iowa's true natural character as a landscape. And it's really very beautiful. And you recently completed a whole new trail system that makes the land an experience more accessible to visitors. And we want to talk about this, but let's start off with talking about the oak savannas. This is one of the most remarkable and noticeable things at the Conservancy. When I was first there on the land, the first time I visited, I was immediately impressed by an extraordinary sense of beauty and grace in the landscape. And I noticed there were enormous sweeping trees, but I didn't know why. It was so beautiful, and what was really what it meant, I didn't really know what I was looking at. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the oak savannas.
Well, the oak savanna really is, more than anything, our claim to fame at White Rock. It's really what makes us special. These oak savannas, is, you could just call it, a kind of a prairie ecology under these wide-spreading trees, which are these bur oaks and these shagbark hickories. And so what it is it's a grassy area with trees, interspersed trees. And the trees that grow up in that environment do have these beautiful sweeping, branches and these beautiful shapes. And, what that is, Iowa used to be 15% to 19% savanna, these oak savanna before the settlers came. And in fact, much of the Midwest was that way. Unfortunately, one of the first things that the pioneers did is that they decided they wanted to move into these beautiful areas, which is understandable. But they also suppressed fire because, fire just destroys things. And what they didn't realize is that these oak savannas can't live without fire. And so in Iowa and throughout the Midwest, basically Iowa has, virtually zero oak savanna left. Not anything to speak of. But at White Rock, we have a full 1,000 acres that we're working to restore. And the way we do that is, these old forests start to fill in without fire with all kinds of other kinds of trees. And then they get deep and dark and entangled.
That's what's so distinctive about this. You're accustomed to seeing forests in Iowa as being very kind of dense and full of lots of little trees. And when you go to the White Rock Conservancy, the forests are very kind of open and clean, and the land under the trees is very accessible.
Yes, it is, and it's also very beautiful. You have these beautiful trees, and then these flowers underneath the trees, and then just the ground itself is covered with these beautiful grasses and other plants. So it is beautiful. It's also incredibly productive. I mean, you have all of these, like a prairie. You have all these plants under the trees, generating all this biomass and flowers and seeds, and then you have the trees overhead, all the oaks and the hickories, and in the wetter places, the walnuts, all dropping all of these nuts. And so it's incredibly productive and really supports a lot of wildlife. And in fact, we have a herd of 300 deer there at White Rock. But there are also species that absolutely can't live anywhere else than in these oak forests. And, animals like or birds like the red-headed woodpecker that is disappearing throughout the Midwest. So it's beautiful and it's productive and very special, and it's a highly diverse habitat.
One of the things noticeable, too, is the trees, they bend down. They reach down to the earth. They aren't reaching up to the sky like you usually see. They're really coming down and creating these very low, heavy branches.
Yeah.
Must be a lot of work trying to maintain that oak savanna. It'll fill in if you don't maintain it.
Yeah, it is a lot of work, especially when you first get started. When you first get started, you can't run fire through a forest like that, because these other trees, they're trying to, these trees that have filled in, they're trying to control their environment. And what they do is they drop these little thin leaves and like maples. And what they're trying to say is, don't burn here. these little thin leaves, they get wet, they pack down, and they try to control their environment. Oak trees, on the other hand, they drop these leaves that are, you know, dry and curly, and they're trying to say, burn. We want our area to burn, because the oak trees know that if a fire comes through, it'll wipe out all the competition. It'll wipe out their own seedlings too, but their own seedlings will come back from the roots. So when you first start to do this work, you have to go in with chainsaws. It's incredibly time-consuming and labor-intensive. But after that, you can start using fire. And fire is our least expensive and most important tool in maintaining these beautiful areas.
You actually invite people to come and volunteer to help with the fires when you do that.
We do. It's not hard work. We're almost completely mechanized, but we do need help. And a lot of people really enjoy burning things up. And hey, at White Rock, you can help us do it, you know, legally, and actually help us maintain something really beautiful.
And that was Conrad Kramer, Executive Director of the White Rock Conservancy, interviewed by Ursula Rudenberg. And I especially loved how he told us about how the glacier created these beautiful hills many, many years ago.
Yes, and you can see them as you drive along all around this area. So now that you know it, you know, that's what the glacier left. Although I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are getting pretty tired of politics, I have a story that is both personal and surprising. When I was marking my absentee ballot, I noticed that there were 5 candidates for senator. So I read the names, and to my surprise, the last one on the list was one that I have known since he was in high school. His name is Michael Lewick Throms, and I met him when I was state coordinator of History Day back in the late 1970s. He was the state winner of the essay contest 2 years in a row and went on the trip to the National History Day in Washington, D.C. If you're a non-party candidate or a minor party candidate, you have different motivations. So I asked him the question, why did you decide to run for the Senate?
You know, I was a junior in high school when Charles Grassley was first elected to the Senate, and now I'm a middle-aged guy with a belly and wrinkles. We have a problem in Iowa with the gene pool of candidates available, but also with the electorate. We have an electorate that, in general terms, likes the incumbent over the challenger, almost regardless of from which party the person comes or who it is. Whether it was Tom Harkin for years and years, or Charles Grassley, or Terry Branstad, he was governor when I was in college years and years ago. So I wanted to throw my hat in the ring and say, we need new blood, new faces, but above all, we need new ideas. And I had no delusions that anyone could just waltz in and overturn the Grassley domination of the senatorial seat. But what I wanted to do and have been doing has been changing the narrative. I've been raising issues that Charles Grassley and his DNC-appointed opposition, Patty Judge, would never raise, very basic issues like the quality of water in Iowa. It's changed so much since I was a boy in the 60s and 70s on a farm in northern Iowa, about living soil, rural communities, and our natural environment. So these are really the very basic issues I want to raise that I don't hear either one of them raising enough and proposing real legislation to make things better.
And so what kind of proposals do you have?
Well, with water, of course, I'm going to start with the most basic of things. If Iowans don't have clean water, we're in a bad way. And it seems to me, I'm a historian, not a scientist, but all my scientific friends confirm this, that our water problems come largely from our way of agriculture and how we're treating the soil. So first we have to address this. We have a secondary problem with water, which are these now flood events that every year or two places like Cedar Rapids or Decorah or other places get inundated. Returning underground water to a state you can drink isn't the matter of decades or even lifetimes, it's generations. So as we mess up the water, we're looking at a problem that we've created for the next 1,000 or how many years. And if the Bakken pipeline really does get put into operation, and if it should spring a leak, we wouldn't be able to correct any poisoning of the groundwater for millennia. So we've got to rethink. And Charles Grassley and Patty Judge are not encouraging us to rethink how we're conducting our agriculture in the state, how we're treating our water. And these are primary problems.
Actually, though, we here at KHOI, who are proud to give voice to the voiceless, frequently focused on many of these problems. Now then, why do you need a Senate candidacy to focus on the problems?
You know, the Senate and the House and the Iowa State House level, those are really day-to-day administrators. The Senate and the House at the state level in Des Moines, it's really getting laws passed. When you look at the Senate and the House, though, at the federal level, there are six Iowans out of 3 million who've been anointed to speak on behalf and act on behalf of 3 million Iowans. So those people, while they look at important federal bills that are on their desk to either vote yes or no on to be made into laws, they're not really doing day-to-day governance. It's more symbolic, certainly the Senate more than the House. And so I'm going in the Senate race as an attempt to influence public policy, because this is really what I want to stimulate reflection on. I didn't throw my hat in to be a day-to-day administrator. I have my sights on something else. I want to talk about really abstract things that are large topics, water, soil, rural communities, but also governance itself. I have found in my campaign that, unfortunately, the media, with exceptions like the one I'm talking on right now, of course, the media protects and perpetuates the two-party system. So I thought the problem with our gridlock on Capitol Hill in Washington was largely a part of partisan politics. It's not that simple. The whole system of how we pick senators and representatives at the federal level, but of course state level, but especially the federal level, it's tainted by the media, the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Television, and others, who have an agenda, and this I know I can explain in detail, to keep any non-democratic, non-Republican voice out of the debate. This is a problem. So if we always do what we've always done, we really are always going to get what we've always gotten, and in this case, we're always going to get Democrats, Republicans. The Democratic Party is the oldest surviving party in the world, founded in 1828. The Republican Democratic parties used to be one. They were hyphenated. The Democratic Republican Party, I think 1799 until 1828. The Republican Party was refounded as a sole party in 1854. These two parties are calcified, rusty, old, geriatric dinosaurs that are in the way of progress, and they're in the way of finding solutions to our problems. So they're actually inhibiting movement forward, and we can't move forward unless we either greatly weaken both of those parties or just get rid of them.
Comments you just heard were from Senate candidate Michael Louis Throms talking about why be a non-major party candidate. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Bob Anders and Amelia Sorensen. We started out the show with Kevin Brooks, president of South Story State Bank and Trust, Marla Mackey, executive director of the Boone County Historical Society, and Conrad Kramer, executive director of the White Rock Conservancy.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for taking care of the technical details of these posts with information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Ballad of Kate Shelley from the same CD and that's it.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
K. KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.